you know, my children, myself. You know, what was the gift that that moved me to a point of inspiration? You know, that moment in time where, like, you know, I wouldn't go as far as to say I see the light, but I saw some kind of light somewhere in me, and it moved me to want to, you know, make big steps. Sorry?
Are you about to, or an empathy, or a mid-cousin?
Can I answer that?
I'm a wannabe. Go on. I'll see. I'm interested to see what my sister-in-law thinks I am before I tell you what I think I am. Yeah, what do you think I am?
She's all three.
You might, my brother.
She's an
Kazakh.
She's,
yes. Yeah, my brother went to he's an FFB, and he went to the Smicha Beisha Torah. So he said to Rebekowitz, like, you
Your
know,
brother?
My brother. He said to Rebekowitz, you know, I'm not a Baal Teshuva. And Rebekowitz said to him, and why not? So that was the end of that conversation.
Yeah, well, my husband had the same reaction. I think that Rabbi Yisrael said to him, like, are you a descendant from Avram?
Yeah, that's
the
right.
Grandfather was.
Right. That's right. Yeah. And I think it's true, everybody. I mean, I suppose I'm one of those fortunate Baal Teshuva who found out that after I found truth, I didn't have to make too many changes because I had it all along. That's how I see myself as being, you know. But, you know, I still wanted to know whether it was true, and I was still nervous that it wasn't, and, you know, so I had to go through that process. I went through a very interesting moment when I was about 15, where I had an insight that made me realize that I'd cracked proving Torah. It was like a huge, momentous occasion, and I spoke to my friends about it, and then I went through the ultimate test. I spoke to my older brothers about it to see if they could make fun of me or stump me, and they were like, oh, you're onto something, so... So I organized this big appointment with Rabbi Silver at the time, who was running Discovery, but I didn't know what Discovery was because I was 15, and who knows what Discovery is when you're 15 and FFB, right? Unfortunately. And I said, I must talk to you. I said, I think I can prove that Torah is valid. He's like, yeah, okay. You know? So I sat down and I presented him this thing that had, like, come to me like a dream. And he smiled. I'm like, why is he smiling? This is so serious. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, it's very interesting, the Kuzari says that. Mm-hmm. I was horrified. I'm like, somebody else said this first? And I looked at him and I said, well, if somebody else said this, why isn't everybody from? Like, I was just horrified. Like, once you know it's true, isn't that the end of the process? No. So I learned that then. But so that moment where something grabs your attention, something wakes up, you know, it's kind of a bit of a gift. At the end of the day, it's a bit of a gift, meaning something might trigger it and something might not trigger it. You may have an experience that creates your own insight. I went to a conference on innate health. I was telling Anita about it, and you know, I almost gave up teaching after this conference because I recognized that people's insights are so much more valuable to them than other people's insights are. That what was the point of sharing my insights with anybody else? I mean, they're valuable to me. The things that make me go, oh my goodness, yes, that's what's valuable. It's not what makes you go, oh my goodness, yes. If you ever sat around someone who is trying to share an insight that meant so much to them, they just sound nuts. Like, I don't care. Like, it doesn't speak to me unless it speaks to me.
That's the skill of a real teacher, though.
To trigger it.
Is to bring you to that, rather than to give it to you, to bring you to it.
Right. So at that point, I decided not to give up teaching, and I just kind of veered myself into the triggering of the insight mode. But even then, you know, you could teach somebody for hours and hours and hours, and then they were walking down the street, and they tripped over the pavement, and it made them realize that there's a God, and you're like, I just spent 50,000 hours trying to tell you there's a God. That's not fair. Yeah. But I think it's very, very choshev to recognize that, you know, you can go insane taking responsibility to be the thing that inspires the uninspired. The moment where a kid, a teenager, a student makes that move from I don't really care to I've just realized that I do care is very much outside of the mechanech's control. You know, you can give a lot of prep and you can get a lot of... information and you can veer them and you can direct them. And so I just want to say that I don't want to talk about the information that steers a person to being inspired, because I think it's enough to drive us machanchem crazy. And we all give a lot of information and we share things that were important to us. And sometimes you have this beautiful moment where something which really hit you strikes somebody else and you see it in their eyes and it's a beautiful moment of exchange. And sometimes you invest and you invest and you invest and some nudnik comes in from out of town and does a little tap show and this person's from. And you just don't really, you know, you just don't really know what it's going to be. So I want to talk about the other aspect of inspiring the uninspired, you know, and again, just drawn really from my own insights of my own experiences, because it struck me as very unnerving that when I look at the people that play a very important triggering role in my life of inspiration, I noticed that there's a lot of other people who put a lot more time into me than they did. And yet somehow it was that madrich, it was that person's speech, it was this, that, the other, that seemed, it was that connection, it was that, you know, moment at 4 o'clock in the morning talking about life that made me, it was something that came. You know, and I want to try and analyze how we can draw the, if you like, the tzelem elokim out of the person. And there's an idea. I'm crazy about this idea. I'm totally fascinated by it. I think it's nuts. Okay, the only face you can't see is your own. You ever think about that? The only face that you can't see is your own. Okay. I had a teacher once, and we were 18 years old, and she was about 327, I think. She looked like at the time to us. You know, she came in with a very thick Polish accent from the shtetls, mamish. And she told us that the very first time she saw her reflection in a mirror was when she was 17.
Wow.
Right? She said, sometimes you saw ourselves in the lake a little bit when the lake was still, which wasn't often. But when I was 17, you know, I went. I went on a horse and wagon with my father to the market, and I saw a mirror, and that's where I saw myself. So we said, all right, can you even imagine? I'm like, look at the kids. All day long, I'm Snapchatting all day long. Like, you know, these kids look at themselves all day long, right? I said to her, she wasn't a pretty woman. I said to her, so, well, what did you think when you saw yourself for the first time? She goes, Dad, I was a little disappointed. You know? You know, and that was the end of that. And she probably went on to keep on teaching. Right? So what's the musahaska? Like, Hashem did. It was because Hashem couldn't figure out where to put our eyes. You couldn't put your eye. Oh, that's me. I'm so sorry. You couldn't. Hashem can design it that we have eyes coming from antennae. Like, there's a reality to that. It's a very significant truth. You ever catch a profile picture of yourself and think, really, that's how long my nose is? Like, you don't see yourself. You see, we can see each other's faces, but you can't really see ourselves. And what does that mean? Oh, we're such a key. We had a whole beautiful, you know, talk yesterday about drawing out the tzelem elokim and giving birth to yourself, but you can't see yourself. You can't see yourself. So how do you see yourself if you can't see yourself? You cannot see yourself. How do you see yourself? So first of all, you have to know your face is not yourself entirely. So that's part of it. You know, it's, you know, what you see, who you are, becomes a function of the people around you. You know, they tell the old joke. You know, if how does it go? If a man goes into the forest and does something wrong, but his wife can't see him, is he still considered to be wrong? You know, that's right. Is he still wrong? Yeah. You know. Yeah. Right. That was the original question. That's it's a.
If a man goes into the forest and says something, is he still,
is he still wrong? That's right. Exactly. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, how do I get a sense of myself if it's not via the normal way of getting sense of things, which is posture through perception? And you start to realize that you get a sense of yourself very much in the reflection of your impact on the world, the version that you do on the world, and on the impact that you make on the people around you. You know, like they tell, there's a whole riddle that they tell about, you know, two people come down a chimney, one person's face is dirty, one person's face is clean, who washes themselves, okay? It's like an old joke, right? But in the end, you see that there's all these possible combinations. well, you would think it's the dirty person, but the dirty person can't see himself. He can see the clean person, so he must assume that he's also clean. So he doesn't wash himself, because if you're clean, then I must be clean. And it's a whole cheshbon on, but then the clean person sees the dirty person, and he washes himself, so the dirty person realizes that if he's washing himself, it must be because he saw my face. It's a whole cheshbon of how you perceive yourself through other people's perceptions. If you walk into a room, and everybody goes, okay, so immediately you start to check, is my skirt up, you know, what happened, something happened, okay? So the people around us play an incredibly important role in our sense of self, and that starts from when we're very, very little. Very, very little. You know, we coo at babies, they have a sense that they exist. They didn't know until then that they existed outside of anything, and suddenly something's responding to them, reflecting them, smiling at them, looking alarmed. When a little kid falls over, everybody says, don't look too alarmed, but if you just smile, they won't even realize that they hurt themselves. And you notice that with children. If they fall over, everybody goes, they cry, and everybody goes, are you okay? They kind of are, because they don't really get yet how much they hurt, even though pain's a very strong sensation. It kind of depends on the reflection of the mother. And I always notice that when you come down in the morning and everybody else is in a bad mood, okay? Possibly, maybe, if you thought about it, you were the one who triggered this, mm-hmm. as the mommy and the hashkafas that you play, right? So there is so much of the other person involved in our sense of self. You know, am I loved? I'm loved by being loved. Am I helping? I'm helping by your feedback. Am I surrounded? My sense of self is so contingent on your response to me. And it struck me that when I think about the people who sort of jumped into my life and didn't really deserve to play the role that they did because they weren't around long enough, they didn't know me deeply enough, why did they trigger me? They triggered me because I couldn't see me. But when I saw them seeing me and they smiled, that told me something about me. And I'm talking about young ages, young impressionable ages. I'm talking about at 13 and then at 17. And that if I can make you smile, that's the first information that I have that I'm worth smiling at. If I can make you invest, that's an information about me via you. And ultimately, when we combine all the things that we learn and all the information that we impart, and we keep on coming back to, it doesn't matter how much information you share, it's the personal relationships, and we wish it wasn't that way because it's so much easier to just, you know, send out a blog to 20,000 people than it is to call somebody. In the ultimate relationship, the person just starts to develop their sense of self through how you relate to their sense of self. And if I'm worth investing in, that might be the very first time in my life that I realized that I was worth anything. I heard a very beautiful story once, an incredulous story, about a woman who was given she was a part of the sort of self-esteem building task force in some really hick downtown somewhere, you know, and it was a group of idealists that were love and harmony, really thrown into, you know, crazy, crazy, abusive, neglected place, parts in America. And she went to a particular school, and she was given the hardest class, and she was given the hardest kids, and she was given about 10 kids to work with. And on the very first day of their meetings, they had a whole bunch of rules, okay, that they decided as a community to build. And one of the rules was you can't interrupt to go to the bathroom until after the session. It was like a, you know, let's share and do this together, like very democratic and peaceful. And one boy had come in late. He was the hardest case in the room, and he came in, and he was quite intrigued, and he listened, and it was all very nice. Anyway, in the middle of the classroom, he puts his hand up and he goes like, you know, I need to pee, you know. And she said, well, that's wonderful. In a very nice, annoying American accent, right? She said, that's wonderful. But, you know, we've agreed that you can't go to the bathroom until after the session. And he's like, I need to pee, you know. And this is going backwards and forwards. Anyway, in the end, he takes a chair and he throws it at the wall and he stomps out. Next day, 7 o'clock in the morning, there's a knock on his door, which took a lot of courage because he wasn't living in a very safe area. And this, you know, half-drunk father opens the door, right? And she comes in and she says, I'd like to speak to whatever the boy's name is, you know, who she describes as being tattooed up the wazoo with criminal records as long as your arm, right? And she turns around and she says to him, so I checked your records. And it says on your records that on the first day of every semester, you take a chair and throw it at the teacher. Well, yesterday, you took a chair and you threw it at the wall. That's progress. I'll see you in school later. And she left, and the guy's like, what? he's just gotten commended for throwing, you know, a chair at the wall. And that was, you know, that was the very first time anybody found anything lovable in this kid, because he was just incredibly unlovable, he thought. And she invests in him and she builds in him, and it comes to a point where she even testifies in court against him because he's done something crazy. And the judge says, well, you know, there's no one who can take responsibility for this kid. This kid's a liability. I want to throw him out. And she says, well, I will. And he says, yeah, you're going to adopt him? And she goes, okay. And she does. You know, and this kid's life turns around because someone saw in him something that made her smile when nobody else could find it. You know, and whether it's us, whether it's our spouses, our poor, wonderful babysitting spouses, right? Our children, our students. We get so incredibly busy with surviving that sometimes I think we perhaps forget to take that moment to just look at a person, you know, and sometimes, l'ta'areinu harav, the people that we care the most about and the deepest about, and we forget to look at them and allow them to make us smile just because this is so fantastic. You know, yes, they're trouble. Yes, they do this here. You know, but do I take a time to just, you know, see in you what you can't possibly see in you because that's the way the Hashem designed it? You find that in a person. You find that in a person, and they see, like I said, in your eyes, the reflection of themselves, and it makes them feel they're worth something. You can touch a person. I don't make an outlandish statement, but possibly in the deepest way that you can touch a person. Possibly in the deepest way that you can touch a person. Because you can help them find the part of them that means that they have a responsibility to invest in themselves. And unless you can get their partnership and their investment of themselves, you can't do it for them. You can't make a person succeed. You certainly can't make a person want to be free. You can't make a person want to, you can't. But you can show them enough of a reason for why they have a responsibility to. Anyway, okay, I just really want, I don't think there's enough time to expand, but I just wanted to sort of, you know, to share that message. So I did. Does anybody have any questions?
That was beautiful.
That
was nice. And I can listen to you talk all day.
Just play Mary Poppins. This is yeah.
Okay, good.
Another question, maybe a comment. Just that it seems that what you're speaking about can really mostly happen in a one-on-one relationship. No? If that's what you're speaking about.
Can it only happen in a one-on-one relationship?
No,
I don't think that's true. Yeah, I don't know that that's entirely true. You know, but that's what's so amazing about this. You know, sometimes you can. I mean, I think it's easiest in a one-on-one relationship. But at the same time, the one-on-one relationship can also get more complicated with other factors that are going on there. Because sometimes, you know, you're teaching a whole group of people, or you're part of a team, or, you know, and either there's a value to the team, which makes people feel a sense of self. Or even in that moment with an anonymous audience that you may never speak again, you know, you kind of make eye contact with the person and, you know, they understand what you're saying and they understand that you've understood something about them that they hadn't managed to articulate. And it can be very powerful also.
I think that is one-on-one, even if the one-on-one okay. is very short.
Okay.
Right? Because okay. it does have to be, you're reflecting them.
Right.
There's something about them that you
right.
get.
Right.
But it can be just like that in a group where you
right.
think, that's a great question.
Right.
And you just validate their intellect.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Well, Vaharai, I suppose you get all these sort of, you know, internet life coaches, you know, who are Anthony Robbins and what do you say? No, I'm not making fun. No, I'm not making fun. I'm attesting to their power. I mean, I don't believe that Anthony Robbins or Jack Canfield or whoever is, you know, intimately know the thousands of people that will ascribe their growth back to them. I think they've just been understood in that moment. I think it's more powerful when a person can say, you understood me as an individual rather than my makeup as a human being in general. But I'm always amazed that, you know, there are certain klalim, you know, about the greatness of a human being that you can relate in the general. And if, and again, you're kind of relying on the person's insight about what you're saying. But if you can trigger them to that point where they suddenly think, my goodness, I do have an achrayus, I am here for a reason, there is a purpose. Even if that's a general statement, you can inspire someone that way too.
I also think I kind of thought you were going in a different direction. And it's also true that the person has to kind of see themselves in you.
Yeah, right, right.
So,
right.
What do you mean by that?
In other words, I could see, it was the first time I could see myself being from. Like, so the person has to kind of see themselves reflected in a little different way than you're speaking, but they have to be able to relate to you or see themselves. In you, in a way.
Right, which is why we do so much good just by breaking stereotypes, you know. I remember this moment, this was so funny, when I had this like girl from out of town or something, and she came into my house, and this is when I was like 20, you know, so I'm not 20 anymore, but I was 20 then, right? And she came into my house and she's like, I thought I was going to like a rabbi in Rabbi's house. I'm like, yeah, come in, you know. She's like, but you're thin. I said, she said to me, I never saw a thin Robertson. I'm like, great, come on in, I'll twirl or something. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, huh? You know, I didn't know quite what to do with it, but it was, you know, like in that moment, she was like, maybe I could become religious, because, you know, she was just, it was such a funny, you're right, there is a certain, you know, identification, whether you're identifying with the soul in general, the human condition, you know, the woman, the college student, the suffering martyr, the powerful, you know, business, whoever that is, there is, yeah, there's an amount of identification, of course, yeah, yeah.
I really like it. I'm struggling to put it together with like the concept that like a lot of my students, they get their, they almost like generate their self-esteem and their self-worth from other people. So therefore, mm-hmm. as much as they're having like a personal relationship with me, who's like a positive person bringing out the positive stuff,
it's the wrong aspect of self. Their understanding of self is based on their accomplishments, their achievements, their looks, their CV, their, you know, sex appeal.
That's a resume.
Yeah, a resume. How do you, yeah.
That's so true.
Right. That, you know. That's right. So again, this whole fascinating idea of if I can't see me, then me can't be the me that I see. There's got to be another deeper me to me. And when you start to... If I can't see me, then the real me needs to be the me that I... It's not the me that I can't see that is the real me.
Okay.
So I'm going to tell you something a little personal. Has anybody come across, you know, Ruthie, don't get too much, Ilana Rosenblatt over the years, mm-hmm. right? Anybody who know who I'm referring to?
Yeah.
Okay, so Ilana Rosenblatt was a very dear friend of mine. You know, she was a Rebbetzin in H. London, and unfortunately, she was nifta, leaving a very young family behind from breast cancer. You know, she was an amazing woman. She never dared to teach until she got sick, and then she started teaching a class. And you would have thought she started teaching a suffering class, but of course, she started teaching Life is Beautiful, and, you know, like just her whole, you know, perceptions changed. Anyway, when she was very sick, so she really wanted to do Cheshbon HaNefesh and grow. And she was kind of too sick to do anything. Hard because she just pushed it and had the kayach. So a couple of us sat together and we said to her, well, what is it that you like to grow in? And these are the really, we didn't know this at the time, this is the last 6 weeks of her life. The last 6 weeks of her functioning life until it was just a downward spiral. And she said, well, I really want to be able to focus on the fact that I'm more of a soul than a body. That's what I really want. You know, again, unbeknownst to us at the time, in preparation for no longer having her body, but like no one said that at the time because we were all kind of hoping that that wouldn't be the case. Anyway, so but it was a problem because she shouldn't have any kayach. So we had to design a growth chart that was that didn't require physical exertion. So a big deal to become like to focus on being a soul rather than a body, but we had to be creative, and we thought of the tiniest little. Things that we could focus on. So one thing was, she would take a look at a baby picture of herself. We all did this together. Because if that was me and this is me and I didn't die and that person's cells regenerated, then surely that can't be me, you know. And we would, you know, when she took a shower on Friday, instead of saying, I'm going to shower, she would say, I'm going to shower my body. Like, which one's me, which one's not me? And I think in our generation particularly, we have made such a tremendous mistake, not in the self-esteem, in the understanding of what it is that we're estimating, in the description of self. If self is how productive I am, how accomplished I am, how pretty I am, how slim I am. So what happens when I'm retired? What happens when I get a wrinkle? I have an incredibly vivid memory of a woman jogging towards me in a park when I was young married in Florida. And it was like a very superficial part of Florida. I can't remember where it was, but the police station with all the criminals was painted pink. You know, I was like, what, really? Okay. are they, okay, whatever. Anyway, and she was jogging towards me. And I just thought, like, I really wish, like, beautiful half-naked women would jog in a different direction. It's, like, not nice when you're in Shonarishon or whatever it was. And she started jogging towards me. And every 10 meters, I'm telling you, this woman gained 10 years. She started jogging. And she was, like, busty and tiny in the right places and the wrong places and blonde and buxom and just, you know, out of a magazine. And as she started jogging towards me, I'm thinking, she's not 20. And she comes close. I'm like, she's not 30. Okay. I'm looking again. No, that's not 40. And she's getting closer and closer. And by the time she's reached me and I can see her face, okay, this woman is like 60, 65. And in my mind, she's running against time. She's like, I'm running. They won't outsmart me. I'm still gorgeous. I'm still 30. I'm just going to keep running. And I'm like, you know, until you drop dead of a heart attack because you're going to be running when you're 90, trying to still look. It was so disturbing. I'm like, first of all, like, you're supposed to be plump. You're supposed to knit. You're supposed to be surrounded by adoring grandchildren. Why are you running? And it was such a disturbing idea because her sense of worth wasn't about her esteem. It was a question of self. Where does your self exist? If your self exists in that, then what self-esteem can you possibly have? You've misunderstood your sense of self. You've looked in the mirror and you've outsmarted God and determined that that's who your self is. So when the esteem is in the wrong direction, and it's not a question of the parts of me that are B'Tselem Elokim, what does that mean? The parts of me that want to be good and that want to give and that want to, you know, like she said yesterday, create and make a difference and empower and love and be eternal and make choices. That's the part of me that I have to estimate. If I misunderstand me, doesn't matter how much esteem I have, it's going to be missing me the whole time. They say, by the way, that it's interesting, they say that musicians and people, celebrities, have a terribly low self-esteem. Why? Because they have an acute sense that the audience is thoroughly in love with this created facade that's got nothing to do with them. Sometimes it's not even their songs, it's hardly their voices. You know, someone has taken them and airbrushed them and given them a uniform and an image and a this and a that, taken somebody else's song, made them sing it, put it through a voice synthesizer, and thousands of people love that person. That person is like the biggest imposter. Me, I'm some nerd who got discovered because somebody put me on YouTube and paid off an agent, right? So if there's an imposter that's being me and that's what I estimate, the gap between me and that self and the self that's trying to be valued, that's when my true self-esteem will shoot down the gap between the two.
You kind of understand
can't possibly understand.
Like,
yeah.
Because of the power that we have, that we are looking at these people who are being told 24/7 that you're all about your outside, and you're seeing something else.
That's right.
And
that's right.
Telling them.
And that's what's making us smile when we look at them, and they're like, oh, yeah, me, real, the real me, really. I'm worth smiling at. I knew it. Right. Yeah.
I love what you had to say. I just want to ask a question. If most of us are not this incredible teacher that knocked at the boy's house and said, like, you don't throw the chair at me. So do you have some practical advice when, like...
I'm louder.
Yes. Absolutely. If most of us... I'm not that teacher that noticed that it was progress that the student didn't throw a chair at me. And I find... You know, I shouldn't speak for most of us. I find that sometimes... I am a little bit irritated by students, and I just want to know if I'm upset about it because I know that I'm the one that's going to see something in them, you know, like the concept that you said. So I want to know if you have any practical advice on how to define that, like, you don't throw the chair at me. Like, for you, that's progress. You know, how to let someone, you know, allow you to smile back at them.
So I tell you what, my husband's Rosh Hashiva used to define love as the reaction that you feel when you focus on someone's virtues, you know. And by the way, students are easy because they leave. You know, it's right. Husbands and children that, you know, that are our constant students who really get on their nerves, you know. I'm a very big believer in being very proactive and falling in love with the people that we're both supposed to be in love with. You know, you look at someone all day long and you look at what they're not doing for you and how annoying they are and how blah, 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 you're going to fall out of love with them because love is a reaction. It's just that you can't control love. Can't control love. You look at someone and you focus. Again, it's so interesting. Who are we kidding ourselves that we can love so many people and that we can just love people? What's the Torah trying to tell us? What do you mean? And how can I love somebody like I love myself? There's a fire and I immediately have a reaction to save everybody altogether. No, I don't. I have a reaction to run. What do you mean love you like you love me? What does that mean? It's such an it seems to be so not psychologically astute as a commandment.
Well, also the fact that it is a commandment.
Right. That's right.
Emotion,
that's right. So, yeah, exactly. And we have this a lot. You know, all these commands. And if you look at all these emotion commands, what you notice is there's clues in them as to how to do them. Okay. And one of the clues, it seems to me, but v'ahavta recha kamocha is this sort of idea of, I'm not sure it's giving us a quantity commandment. I think it's giving us a quality commandment, meaning I don't know that it's possible to generate as much love for everybody as you love for yourself, your husband, and your children. I just don't think we're designed that way. But there's a method, kamocha. What does that mean, I love myself? What does that mean, I love myself? It means that in a situation, the first thing that I do is give myself the benefit of the doubt. You know, when I'm driving, you know, you're the idiot, because I realize that you didn't wait for me to, you know, you don't tend to turn around and just assume that they're right and you're wrong. You tend to have rachmanis for your situation. You have an understanding of your context. You give yourself an excuse. There are some things that we do that naturally we trigger love for ourselves because we focus on our positives. And when we start focusing on our negatives, we lose the love for ourselves, by the way, right? So it's how I fall in love. How I fall in love is by doing for others what I do for you. I get a sense that I'm misunderstood, that I'm deep, that if you knew me better, you'd also love me, that if you judge me, you've misunderstood me. I have a certain natural compassion. Even if I'm a bit of a self-loather, I still understand why I've become so tough in my life, because if you knew what I went through, then you'd also hate everybody. Like, I get me, and I'm Donnikov Schuss myself, very, very naturally. So if I can use that method to say, who are you? What's your pain that can create compassion? What's your strength that can create admiration? And if I'm frustrated with you because you're not using your koichus enough, and that's my frustration, then maybe I need to build the relationship to the point where I can tell you that I'm only annoyed at you because you're better than this, and it hurts me that you don't know this. You know, and that's a proactive thing. Otherwise, you can't command a reaction, an emotional reaction, unless there's a method. So how do I fall in love with people? How do I look at my spouse and say, you know, I'm really annoyed at him that he puts his socks on the floor, but he pays for my electricity, and I haven't said thank you in 10 years. Like, can I reconjure my positive feelings towards him? Can I look at him and just think, you know, he loves me. He's put up with me. He tries so hard. Can I create love like I love myself? I'm always you notice you don't have to close yourself all day long. It's so hard. I'm so tired. Da da da. You know, you don't turn around and say, wow, I'm so crazy. I just tore my kid off. You're like, I'm just so stressed out. Like, I screamed at my kids. I feel so bad. But the first thing you do is you're Donnikov's close. The first thing you do is you understand why you did it, because you love yourself. Apply the method. And your reactions change. That's why our reactions are commanded, because there's a method to getting to a place of love.
Can I say the end of Tamar Devar, we talked about that in the Yigil Midas Harachamim, which is what Tamar Devar was about. It goes through all the Yigil Midas Harachamim, how Hashem expresses them, what they are in Hashem, and how He expresses them. But the last several really bring you to a place where you try to see the chayim even inside the least chaimedic person. So getting down to like the homeless person on the street, you know, with the cardboard sign, that if you could at least see in him the baby that he was,
right,
you know, like at least like just that newborn, even if he wasn't loved, but he was probably born into a hospital and clean at one point and wrapped in something clean at least once before he went to a miserable or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But there was some, he was cute once.
Yeah.
You know, like if you could try to see that in there and connect his back. Like, but it really goes down to like that level.
Right.
Tried to, and it really talks about all different ways to try to see something in the person
right.
that you can relate to.
It's a nice muscle, but people are like stars. If you can't see them shining, you're just too far away from them.
I also love what you said, like you get to a point where like you could be annoyed that they're not expressing themselves well because they're better than that. So if they're sitting there like not even picking up their own plate, not saying thank you, like that's like upsetting that a talent that look here is not in touch with the facts or your circumstances didn't allow you to
act
decently.
That's right. And it is...
But I don't not like you at your essence.
Right. Right. Well, that's in Aschenam, is identify you with the mistakes that you're making rather than, you know, the good person underneath that.
Right.
For a teacher to turn around to say to a kid, you know, you're a disturbance and you don't concentrate, it's very different too. Tell me why a kid like you is not behaving like a kid like you should. That kid is like torn between, I hate you, I love you, thank you for knowing me, thank you. You know, like that builds me. They believe in me more than I believe in me. Maybe they're right. Maybe. Maybe they're more right than my mom was. Maybe they're more right than, you know, my friends who didn't play with me were. Maybe there's something redeemable in me. Yeah.
I was just going to ask, really very much enjoying what you're saying. But we're people, and we invest so much into these people that we're working with, and that we're actually doing a good job. It's from the deep relationships that we build. We put our kishkas into these people for years and years and years, and then something happens, you know, they'll start dating a non-Jew, pull back, you know, stop coming for Shabbos, whatever it is, and you put yourself into them. So it's not so much that you can't, even if you come forward and you can speak to them and say, like, this, you're above this, this is not where you're coming from, but still, our humanity gets in the way. Do either of you, anyone have, like,
like it's not about me. We should have that mantra all day long.
It's not
this
about
is not personal.
They're not looking for me. These are real relationships. These are not fake relationships.
And then they notice that you're frustrated, and they see that there's like a personal agenda. That's the worst.
Right.
When they tell you the news of like, I'm not going to continue learning, and you're like. They see the disappointment, and then it becomes selfish.
Or the minute they keep Shabbos, it's like a big party. Oh, that's why you like me, because, you know, you got another sick.
Asked me once why I only call her and invite her for Shabbos.
Yeah. Ruthie, what did you want to say?
No, I was just going to say that I think it happens to be, to my detriment, maybe one of my strengths, because I'm able to detach a lot, maybe too much in certain situations. But I do think that... just based on what Ilana was saying, it's so contingent on your own strong sense of self. Meaning, like, the only way that you're able to detach enough to be able to say, look, I can see the good in the person, I can invest, I can give everything I can give. But also, it's, you know, there's Bechira, there's a reality, there's a Kodesh Baruch who's involved on their journey. It's not necessarily going to be a direct result of my efforts that's going to take this person from A to B. I'm just a partner with Hashem. I'm trying to do what I can do. And I went. But at a certain point...
As a therapist, when you work as a therapist, it's like, I can have that level of detachment.
Right.
But the dynamic is so drastically different, I feel like, when I'm working.
Right. But I think that that level of detachment is key in terms of A, preserving your sense of self, and being able to just continue to invest. Otherwise, like, you can't continue to invest if you feel that your sense of self is being affected, or your, you know, your stability, so to speak, is being affected by someone else's success or not success.
What do you think the difference is between as a therapist and as a...
I think there's a level.
There's just boundaries. There's different boundaries.
A lot more boundaries. They're not coming into your environment. You know, these people are inviting into our house, into our family. They become, some of them become, you know, essentially family members.
Yeah.
You know, you really, you learn with them weekly or see them weekly. You know what I mean? It's not the your clients or patients you see weekly also, but it's in a very confined, specific parameters where the, you know, people you come in, you give a hug. I don't touch my clients, you know, like.
Also, if not, if my client tells you something like, I realize what you said is an improvement, like our students, if they realize what we said and they're not keeping Shabbos, you know, there's.
I wanted to say something, having teenage kids. Great preparation for teenage kids.
I was thinking the same thing.
Okay, but I just want to say that I think this is important. Like with our kids, like we also invest. Right. We give them the tools so that they can make choices and that they don't always do what we want to do. It's painful for us, but really they have their own bechira, and I think that having, like, when you're a therapist, because I'm also a therapist, and I get it, like, part of your training as a therapist is detaching. You don't really want to detach from your students or your children. That's really what you're saying, is you don't want to be their therapist, you don't want to detach, because part of it is it's a different relationship. So even though there's going to be sometimes some pain, and sometimes there's going to be nachas, that's kind of what it is. And I mean, it's not to the extent of our students, but I just feel like there is a part of that that is what makes us successful in being able to be, not, again, as therapists that wouldn't be successful, but as a teacher in the kind of roles that we do, because we're not just teachers, we're kind of like reparenting a lot of these people, you know?
It is, and you know what gives me sort of perspective sometimes also. I just think to myself, you know, this poor student, okay, life was perfectly wonderful until I came in and bothered everything, you know, and after 6 months, you know, they have so deeply disappointed me because I was hoping by now they break up with their love of their life that happens not to be Jewish, that they, you know, and they would by now give up all their most favorite foods that they've eaten for the last 20 years and relished, and by now they'd give up, you know, going to the beach on Shabbos, and I feel so much disappointment, and then I get a real big reality sort of, I don't know what the word is, but like a reality check, right? And I think to myself, so if they, who've known about this because I've been their teacher for 6 months, have upset me so much because they're not keeping Shabbos, so how does Hashem feel that I spoke Lashon Hara? How does Hashem feel that I was mean to my children? Meaning, we get a little bit caught up in falling in love with these people's potential and their results. And I think what happens with your teenage children when they quote-unquote disappoint you is that you are at some point pushed into defining their humanity beyond the results, beyond the externals, beyond the things that make you a good parent and that actually allow them to be a good person. And to some degree, when you've got a student who's supposed to be officially by the handbook keeping Shabbos because it's been 3.5 months and therefore they've been to enough classes that they should know, you know, and they're not, and you still love them, to some degree you've become more human.
I think that's the key. Like, I think with your children and with your people that you put a ton of energy into, and you feel like you're getting to this point where they're getting frustrated and you're getting frustrated, the only thing you can do is just love them. And
right.
They feel that because that love is recognizing their virtues. So even if they're not doing what you want them to do, and they're not at that point, you can let go a lot and just step back, but continue to just give love and see them in that way, and they will feel that, and they will still feel connected, even if they're not doing what you're doing. And they might come back a year later or 2 years later, and because you're constantly giving them that love and that recognition of their virtues and what they do have, because everybody has something.
But even a drop more than that, a drop more, because I'm very much with you on what you're saying. You know, even the reality that your image of what is a success is a little bit playing God too. Meaning, you know, they weren't good today. They didn't make a good choice. They didn't do something beautifully human at some point today. That, you know, just because on your agenda they didn't do what they were supposed to do, suddenly they're a write off. Meaning, you know, it sort of forces me to take a look at really the human making human moral choices, making good choices, and to recognize that I can't play God over her. It's not my right to decide that you're a success because you managed to keep Shabbos. It's not my place to do that. My place is to be a kli to your falling in love with your own potential, and to trust you with that and love you through that, and believing in you the whole process. It's you're not about my ego, you know. And as much as we care, that gets confused.
Yeah,
so we do have divine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll talk quick.
Okay, you talk quick. You're in New York, but you can do that.
I could talk really fast. I could talk faster in Spanish. It just sounds faster, but much lower. Anyway, so the thing is, I just want to know if there's something wrong with me, with my connection to people, or if I have a brilliant philosophy. Because so you all tell me, okay? Because I don't feel any of this. I feel connected to my people, to my students, to whatever, and I don't take anything personally, nor do I feel like, you know what I mean? And I wonder if I just don't really connect with them well, or if it's because my philosophy is I have no expectations for them, and therefore I have no disappointments. So should I
be disappointed?
Much younger than you?
No, they're mostly older than me, but also my age. I'm saying college kids and older, whatever. But I, you know what I mean? So I wonder, I don't have expectations, specific expectations. What? No.
Dream on.
I'm not connected to the real me.
I could say that.
Okay, I got my answer.
Thanks. No, you have a brilliant
philosophy.
I'd say that's
great. Do you think, because I mean, that's my philosophy, because, and I really have no disappointments, but I don't know, can I do that and yet still have a connection with them? Because I feel like I do, but I got a little, like everyone's talking about disappointment and taking it personally, and I don't feel that. I just want to make sure I'm on the right track.
I think it's okay to understand that everybody has different chemistry. Different people have different levels of attachment and detachment.
Right.
That's natural.
Some but people, she feels attached.
I do feel
that.
I have relationships with them.
But I'm using attachment in the
right.
Right. So different people have different levels of enmeshment.
That's right. That's right. Well, that's again. It's the distinction between the self and the other. I'm myself. I'm within my boundaries. You are the other. I want to reach into your world and love you and care about you without confusing, you know, you with me.
It's like I love you and have a relationship with you and I respect you. Even if you don't make any, you don't have any changes for me.
Right.
No, or for anything.
It's not
dependent. For me, but no, you're saying that for me. But then you take it personally. You know what I mean? You're saying, no, it's not for me. But
no,
then
it's
it is
not.
Personal.
When your student marries somebody not Jewish, you're hurt at your core.
It's like a pain.
It's
not
really,
like a,
it's like this.
Well,
like,
I'm sad for
like
them.
You made a bad
personal.
Choice for you.
It's not
yes, it is.
But I like what Alana said. Maybe
okay,
I don't make a choice. Maybe
them.
That's not where the real fear was. Well, I'm not
like,
Hashem.
I'm going to wrap it up, and I'm just going to give you a quote from the boss of your Rebbe, which is, the greatest gift God gave to mankind is free will. And unfortunately, gave it to our children as well.
Unfortunately.
It is all from him. He didn't say it to me. So helpful. So okay, so what's happening in this room right now is sharing materials, curriculum series with Bidi Deutsch, Rochevin Geltuff, and Evelyn Lewis. Next door is Juggling Hats with Rachel Goldbaum. Down the hall is Making the Most of One Month with Hannah Goldstein. Rabbi Gesell probably
didn't
let his group out yet, is my guess. So we will take a 2-minute break and then show up in the rooms that we want to be in. And everything's just going to run a little bit late. Or everybody should just shorten their sessions just a little bit so we can do them.
I thought I
didn't
know.
Okay. You're in twice.
Yeah, I know.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This way.
Here and here. Right, because these are three choices.
Detach in my way of life.
Oh, fabulous.
So you're here and here. So you're first of
all. Right.
So you're in a person of one this time.
I cannot know what he wants from someone else.
Okay.
Well, I could do.
This room is
just
where are you
right?
No, I'm kidding.
Well,
I'm
trying
to
do.
Don't say that. I'm sorry. I'm sharing materials for
you. But it's the more, as a young teacher, whatever. I was for sure.
So invested. So confused between their results
and
your results.
Kids is like with kids, they let you.
Yes.
Right. New York adults, you learn, and I feel like it was such a good learning process for us.
Right.
Yes.
We stay clearly. We don't think it's our place to decide what someone else does. People walk in, they're like, "What comes to the forest?" They're like, "Well,
That's a shame.
taped it.
You know what's so true?
It was not amazing.